Conference record has joined the conference.
Hey, Tim, are you still with me?
Yes. It's Greg, right?
No, this is Dylan, actually, is my name. No, it's okay. And I'm just going to give a little introduction for the listeners and ask a couple of questions. This is Dylan Mule. This is Dylan Muhlberg of Grateful Web, here with Tim O'Brien, who is widely acknowledged as a master songwriter and virtuoso multi-instrumentalist. His groundbreaking style fuses various elements of country, blues, bluegrass, and folk, while remaining progressive in character. Mr. O'Brien co-founded the Colorado Bluegrass Institution, Hot Rise, back in the late 1970s, and additionally has built an exciting solo career, including endless collaborations with other legends of the country and bluegrass world. Thanks so much for joining us this morning, Tim.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Likewise, your music continues to reveal important root qualities of country and folk music. At the same time, your compositions and songwriting reflect a playful, progressive nature. Is it a challenge achieving this balance?
Well, I've achieved the balance in spite of myself. I mean, I really try to make things understandable, but I'm also so rooted in tradition that stuff will sound reminiscent of that, even if it's about a modern subject, I guess. It's an interesting process, you know, to try to be a traditional musician and to be, to stay creative, because you can sort of get bogged in down and trying to copy people. And at some point, you just gotta be yourself.
Absolutely. And speaking of which, Flat, Scruggs, and Monroe were considered genre benders when they pioneered the bluegrass sound. Do you feel there is a line to be drawn with contemporary bands that further fuse outside elements, or is there a place for some evolution in instrumentation?
Well, you know, it's going to happen regardless of what anyone protests about. Music keeps evolving. You know, it evolves because our culture evolves, and because technology evolves, different things are possible. All of a sudden, people start thinking in new ways. What's interesting is that the basic themes keep coming back. I feel like the music is always safe. There's no reason to be worried about it, because the basic elements still come back, and they become valuable again when they're ignored for too long. And that's why you have people like Del McCurry, who are setting the woods on fire here as traditional bluegrass fans, you know, young and old, are latching onto that incredible power of the traditional sounds. And it's also why, you know, it has to evolve, and that's why you have stuff like the Punch Brothers, you know, where it's gone into classical and jazz, and it's all kind of interrelated. It always has been interrelated, but they're just showing new facets of that. Phil Monroe was certainly a radical in his day. He was combining jazzy elements to the tradition that he grew up with in Kentucky, you know, the old ballads and the old fiddle tunes and stuff that his mom played and sang, and the blues that he learned from Arnold Schultz. But he went to Chicago, heard Dixieland jazz. He thought, well, maybe I can add some of this together and play it on a mandolin, and it'll be my music. Now we have everybody doing that same kind of thing, trying to make their own music, and it keeps evolving, and it's a natural thing. We're everything's safe, and everything's always changing at the same time.
Sure. Very, very good. You grew up in West Virginia, became a legend in Colorado, then completed the journey by moving to Nashville in the 90s. How has your changing surroundings influenced your style?
Well, Colorado was good because there was a lot of, you know, I moved to college town, and there's a lot of kids striving to learn music, and the clubs were happening. You know, I was of an age where I had the energy to go out and hear music whenever I could, and everybody was, you know, it was a lot of activity. People of a certain age group were kind of collaborating. And also the mountain culture there, sort of, Colorado's kind of like a place where people go for a better life. They love the weather. They want to, maybe they want to go skiing, mountain climbing, river rafting, I don't know, hiking. Maybe they just like the weather, sunny weather and clear air. So it kind of breeds an open-minded person. They're coming there for a better life. They're kind of going out to hear music more. Colorado's always been strong for that. So it affected it. It was a nurturing environment. And then, of course, moving to Nashville, you get a more of a sense of, like, you feel like you're going around the track pretty fast, you know. But then you get on the track with the people from Nashville, they're going a little faster, and they're kind of making more deals. They're kind of higher. They're kind of more finely tuned as musicians because they have to be to compete. So you get that competition there kind of helps you hone your craft. You know, you have to keep up with people. You can also get sort of bogged down in the commercialism and the trends that you're trying to chase a trend. You know, that's like as soon as you're trying to follow a trend, then you're behind. And so that can be a trap there, because everybody's trying to get the next country radio hit. And if you imitate what was the hit last week, you're probably not going to make that happen.
Sure, I always think of the Altman film, It Still Rings True Today.
Sure.
So, yeah, absolutely. So through your music, though your music is often described as being Americana or roots, I've seen you collaborate brilliantly with non-American artists such as Irish fiddler Kevin Burke. Do you feel limited by the labeling of Americana?
No, I don't feel limited at all. I mean, that label is just a grab bag of anything that has to do with America. And
sure.
Guess what? There's a lot of Irish immigrants to America over the years. There's a lot of, you know, we had a huge slave population. Now we have a race issue. We have, we're not limiting. There's nothing limiting about Americana. It includes music from Europe and America and Asia. It doesn't, you know, it's anything American, really, and it's, and it's not, you know, bluegrass can be limiting. Bluegrass, that label can mean, oh yeah, you can't have an electric guitar, you can't have a drums, you can't have electric bass even, you know, you shouldn't even plug them in. I mean, that, if you want to, you can define bluegrass that way, and that could be limiting. But Americana, man, that's all over the map. You'd make your own sound within this giant genre.
Yeah, absolutely. You have a new album out with old friend and collaborator Daryl Scott. Memories and Moments is a gorgeous bare-bones musical revival with mostly new originals and a few covers. Many of the tracks sound decades old, as if they were old-time tunes taken from the folk canon. How did the two of you manage to create these fresh tracks with such sincere nostalgia?
Well, I just think that Daryl Scott is... He's got deep roots. He's got his sort of touch as a sort of it reaches down almost to like the center of the earth or something. I mean, he's kind of like he's got a mysterious sense, or you know, he's got this uncanny sense of music and of lyric, wordplay, metaphor. And he deals with the real issues of the people's lives. Again, it's just like, you know, both of us are trying to get at the real things, musically and lyrically, I guess. And Hank Williams and Bill Monroe, we do a Hank Williams song and a George Jones song on there, and we do a song by John Prine along with John Prine. You know, and they're kind of just, those are three steps on the tradition. you know, starting with Hank, but, Hank, and then George Jones and John Prine, it kind of, our songs are our own songs, but they're definitely tempered by those influences. And, I don't know. It's just, also I think that taking away a lot of other instruments, when you just have two instruments and two voices, you have a much more up close perception of the music as opposed to a big production. You don't have, sheen, necessarily a big, kind of a polished sheen to things. You're just dealing with more basic elements. I don't know, people, you know, it's like, I found that from doing duets with my sister Molly that, when there's two parts sung and not a third part, then people are feel welcome to sing along in their car or their house, you know, wherever they're listening to the music. It's kind of approachable, and without a whole band there, you know, you can imagine yourself in the mix. I think that's part of the secret. It's not a secret, but it's part of the. It's a key thing to the way we get, you know, closer to people with the music.
Absolutely. Listening to Memories and Moments, all of the tracks evoke those feelings to me as well. So Scott and yourself will continue your musical brotherhood by touring in support of Memories and Moments, starting in Nashville this September. It's been a while since the two of you toured together exclusively. Do you expect there will be a learning curve reacquainting to each other's current musical self?
Yeah, it's, there'll be a little bit of a, you know, I'm sure we'll get more comfortable with it, although it's always been very comfortable whenever we play, and it's funny, like, we played at the end of May at a festival, and that was the first time in a while, other than recording. The live show is a lot different than a recording, but we were there, and Daryl was actually kind of nervous before the show asking what songs we knew. And so we started making this list, and it got to be real long. And then we played a few of those, and then we got on stage, and we ended up playing a whole bunch of songs that weren't on that list. It's not like rocket science with us. I mean, it's just he plays a song, and if I don't know the song, I'll listen until I can sort of do something that complements it. And he's the same way. And in fact, he listens and responds so quickly that it's almost like he never had to learn it. I mean, it's just sort of complimenting him from the get-go. It's, I don't know. part of the thing that we aim for is to get at something new and then play it differently than we played it before. So in a way, we don't really want to get that comfortable. We want it to kind of, want to be some sort of sand in there to mix the oyster, you know? So he'll consciously mess it up to help him think a different way. He'll change the capo in the middle of the song. You know, he goes from a whisper to a roar and back again. It's really inspiring to be on a stage or in studio next to him.
Wonderful. I know fans are absolutely thrilled for the revival of your collaboration, including myself. So let's talk for a moment about Hot Rides. Over a decade ago, after the untimely passing of Hot Rides co-founder Charles Sawtelle, the legendary outfit continued to perform and has continued to perform more and more frequently with Nashville flat picker Brian Sutton. Why was it important to you, Nick and Pete, to revive and continue playing as Hot Rise?
Well, Hot Rise was 12 years, our full-time career, you know, started in 78, and we went full-time through into the spring of 1990. And so we had the 12 years of collaboration, and we were kind of growing up as musicians in that time, all of us. And Pete Wernick and Charles Sawtelle, maybe, they certainly have more experience than Nick and I, both performing and recording, but we all kind of were learning together. And So, you know, a dozen years later, we continued to do some shows. I had to move on. I felt a need to kind of branch out and do my own thing. It was a solo career. But it was too hard to let it go. It was too much a part of who each of us are, that experience. And so it was easy enough to, it wasn't like we had a big argument and quit. It was more like, well, this has kind of taken, gone as far as I, in my mind, it had gone kind of as far as it would go for a while. And I needed a change. And so the change was starting to happen, but also I missed the, you know, I didn't want to just say goodbye to those guys. Of course, a lot of people wanted us to stay together. And then as the years go on, it was a great reunion, you know. It was like a family reunion, like a yearly one, you know. We'd do a few shows. Now we're in the process of making a new recording. So that also has been a long time coming, but it's necessary for the same reasons. We, as musicians, we've grown separately, and now we can come back together and offer some new things. And I think what we started with already is promising. I think it's going to be a good recording. And it brings back that sound of the four of us. Well, Brian Sutton has been a member for 10 years now. So I'll call him one of the four of us. He's not the new guy so much anymore. It's time to just own up that we still have a band and make a record and do a few more shows. I think after Daryl Scott and I travel for a year, we won't go full time with Hot Rods, but we will do more shows than we have done in previous years, I think.
Absolutely. That's thrilling. One more question for you, Tim. Does humor belong in bluegrass music?
Well, humor has always been there. Bill Monroe, I'm reading some stuff about him in the early days. He actually was working up comedy routines, and he actually dressed in drag on early shows before he was on the Opry. They were coming out of the days of vaudeville, well, not vaudeville, it was minstrel shows, and blackface. They might have tried some of that, too. I think they may have had a guy in there that did some blackface comedy. But, you know, it's always been part of it. He would sing songs like, you know, they're like children's songs, like Shady Grove. You know, they're just clever little ditties, and it might be have a little humor in them. He was a serious man, but I think he believed in poking fun at himself, and. Humor in bluegrass, it gets a little bit serious sometimes, and I think humor helps temper it. Stanley Brothers used to do the routine, the old Arkansas Traveler routine, where the one guy's lost and he's asking directions of the other guy, and he thinks that the other guy is he's lost in the country and he's trying to find his way to Little Rock, and he talks about how, you know, can you tell me how to get to Little Rock, and how deep is this mud puddle? And the farmer says, well, I reckon the water goes all the way to the bottom. And then, you know, the lost guy goes, well, this road go to Little Rock? And he says, no, it doesn't go anywhere. It stays right here. And he says, well, you don't know that much. He says, well, I don't know that much, but I'm not lost. So it's like the city slicker trying to make fun of the country guy, that's an enduring thing in bluegrass music. There's that dichotomy, you know, playing those parts. But Hot Rods was always about, we tried to make good, strong music, but we also poked fun of ourselves. So it was like when the music started, we were serious. Even when Red Knuckles and the Trailblazers were on stage, we tried to play the music well. But it helps to reveal your, you know, that you're not perfect. Poke fun at yourself. That gets everybody on the same page. Humor gets everybody on the same page in the audience. You're all sharing in the same thing. You kind of laugh. We're laughing with, well, I mean, it's not laughing at ourselves, maybe, but to poke fun at ourselves, we kind of, everybody realizes that we're all kind of equals in this. So I think humor is very valuable that way.
Lovely. Well, Tim, I really wanted to thank you for your time. You've been a musical hero of mine since I was a child. I'm 25 years old. My folks have been taking me to see Hot Rise here in Colorado. As long as you've been performing it in my life, I want to encourage all Grateful Web listeners to check you out at the Rocky Grass Festival with Lomax Project and your own Tim O'Brien band, and to listen to the new release with Beryl Scott, and catch you on the road this September.
Yeah, it's going to be great. There's one more, there's a couple more things I'm doing at Rocky Grass, which is playing with Andy Statman, who's an incredibly innovative player from New York. I was privileged to play on his recording that's new, coming out soon. And he adds a sort of progressive jazz, or sort of like tonalities from progressive jazz along with bluegrass, classical music, R&B. So that's exciting. And then there's also a thing on Saturday night with Jerry Douglas called the Dukes of, or some of the Earls of Leicester. The Earls of Leicester is a play on the Platt and Scruggs, Earl and Leicester, Earl Scruggs and Leicester Platt, the Foggy Mountain Boys. We're doing the repertoire of the Foggy Mountain Boys on our show, and we have instrumentalists and singers who can really cut the stuff. Jerry's organized this, and Charlie Cushman's the great Earl Scruggs purveyor. Sean Camp is playing the part of Lester Platt. I'm playing the part of the tenor singer and mandolin player Curly Seglin. We have the fiddler Johnny Warren, whose dad was Platt and Scruggs' fiddle player for about 12 years. Johnny just plays exactly like his father, and it's very exciting. Jerry gets to be Josh Graves on the dobro, so it's very exciting to play the real traditional stuff, and also to get, you know, with Jerry, but also then get pretty progressive with Andy all on the same weekend. It's kind of the whole spectrum of things, going from Alan Lomax field recordings all the way into the classic bluegrass sound into something more modern with Andy. So it's quite a weekend for me.
Yeah, I can't wait. Thanks so much for revealing details about the Saturday Night Headliner. Thrilled to hear that you're a part of it. And again, thank you so much for your time. Our listeners and readers will be thrilled to hear all of your insights. Until then, take care and catch you over the weekend.
Okay, Dylan, thank you.
Thank you so much, Tim. Take care. Bye.